I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In Sunday's New York Times Sunday Review section, an article, and fascinating one it was, Sam Polk is the author, a former bond and derivative trader for Bank of America and King Street Capital Management. And it's about his time on Wall Street, where his bonus was $3.6 million, and he was angry that maybe it wasn't big enough. He was 30 years old, no children, no debts, no philanthropic goal in mind. He just wanted to make more money. As he writes, it's the exact same reason an alcoholic needs another drink. He was addicted. He left 3 years ago, and he has since founded Grocery Ships, which is a strategy to temporarily provide families with money to buy whole plant foods and enroll them in a comprehensive program of nutrition, cooking, and shopping education. And our conversation about money is timely because you'll no doubt be aware that yesterday Oxfam released a report showing the richest 85 people on the globe own as much as the poorest, 3.5 billion or half the world population. The richest 85 people own $1.7 trillion. Sam also has a suggestion for those who are at the top of the Wall Street ladder to perhaps give up some of their money and put it in a fund. And, oh, what could be done with that money, huh? We'll be welcoming phone calls for Sam. We're going to talk for a while, and then we'll take your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for being with us. Your article was absolutely fascinating, and I'm really delighted you can be with us. You write early on, and sometimes I guess we forget how important our early influences in life, our parents, what their values are. And you talk about your dad believing that money would solve all of his problems. And for about, 22 to 30, you thought the same thing, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, when we were growing up, it wasn't that we were poor. It was that we were sort of middle income, but just sort of struggling to get by. And my mom had a pretty steady job as a nurse practitioner, but my dad, sometimes he tried to write a screenplay and he would kind of go from job to job. But he was always talking about that big score, that moment when he'd sell a screenplay or he'd sell a business and everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I grew up believing. I sort of, every problem that was going on in my life, I know that he sort of blamed on money. And so I started to, too. And I started to kind of create this fantasy about, hey, this future when everything would be okay and everything would, when I would fully have enough. And, I spent the better part of a decade really trying to make that happen.
And you were making an incredible amount of money. But what was fascinating about this piece is that no matter how much it was, it just wasn't enough for you, wasn't enough for your coworkers. And most of us would look at that and say, come on, what are you going to do with all that money?
No, I know. I mean, it sounds crazy. It's hard to, really fathom that Wall Street is this place where when you earn $500,000 a year, it's as if you're earning pennies.
Mm.
And that's it's sort of a shocking thing to think about. But at the same time, I believe we all sort of take on the belief system and value systems of our culture. And so Wall Street, when I was working on Wall Street, every day I was talking to Wall Street people at this bank or at this hedge fund, and they were all talking about money. And, Wall Street is this place that has its own language. But one of the things about Wall Street language is that oftentimes people can be introduced sort of by the amount of money that they're worth.
So, oh my gosh.
So somebody will say like, oh, you got to meet my friend John. He's a $200 million guy.
Oh no.
Or you got to meet Joe. He's got 25 sticks in the bank. Stick is a word for millions on Wall Street. And so it just became like sort of part of this ethos of the place that, I would be working on a trading desk and across from me would be a guy that I knew was worth $100 million. And so I would think about how I would see the sort of respect that he got within the place I was working, and I'd see the kind of deference that people showed him, and I'd say, well, I want $100 million too. And, you know, I don't say this, like I talk about this and it's, you know, really interesting, but it is also sort of sad.
It is sad.
Because in the end, you know, I remember even early on, like in my first couple of years of getting a bonus, my first bonus was a $40,000 bonus. My second bonus was a $75,000 bonus.
Wow.
And I remember this feeling of getting the bonus and then thinking, okay, I'm going to go buy something with this. And then being like, well, actually, I don't even really know what I want to buy. I don't really care about clothes that much.
Oh,
I don't,
no.
I live in New York. I don't want to buy a car. I don't have enough for a house yet. So, and it was sort of this, that was, the, I guess, the first moment where I really started to see, like, hey, maybe money is not about what we think it's about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot. Oh, it makes a lot of sense to me. It makes a whole lot of sense. I don't concern myself probably enough with it, some would say. The interesting thing, too, and I'm wondering if you can say that other people in Wall Street, you talk about addiction frequently in this piece, and you struggled with some addictions before you even got out of college. Was there a similarity between a drug addiction you had and a money addiction? Is there anything the same about that?
Yeah, and I'll even answer your question in a bigger way. I believe all addictions are the same. So there's 35, I think Wikipedia lists 35 different 12-step groups. There's Debtors Anonymous, Under-Earners Anonymous, there's Overeaters Anonymous, there's Hoarders Anonymous, there's Online Gamers Anonymous. And all these things are different. There's Narcotics Anonymous for drug users, Alcoholics Anonymous for alcoholics. And all these things, they follow the same structure. And my belief, and let me just say that this is just only my belief. Like, I can only speak from the perspective that I've come to through my experiences. And I honestly don't know if it's right or wrong. It's just mine.
Mm-hmm.
But my belief is that all addiction comes from this. So I don't even want to sound so grandiose. Like, most addiction or much of addiction comes from this sort of spiritual malady, is what my counselor used to call it. I sometimes call it, you know, a hole in the soul.
Mm-hmm.
This place inside that feels empty, that, you know, I sort of think about it as like, you know, a disconnection from sort of the value and wholeness that we're born with.
Right.
Does that make sense? Like, I
yeah.
think about, one of the things I think about is like babies, you know, like, you know, babies, we know that they're valuable. They don't have to do anything or be anything or say anything cute. You just see a baby and you know that is a sacred being.
Mm-hmm.
And for me and my addiction, somewhere along that line, my sense of my own kind of value and my own power and my own sacredness got severed. And so I was sort of, I had a hole inside me. And so when I was young, I tried to fill it with drugs and alcohol. And fortunately, you know, circumstances conspired, and that was mostly me getting in trouble and then me getting dumped by a girlfriend, you know, caused me enough pain so that I needed to confront those particular addictions. The problem was that, so that was great. And I've been off drugs and alcohol for now about 11 years.
Great.
But the other thing is that, you know, that still, that hole was still inside me, and getting sober from drugs and alcohol was, for me, just the first step in sort of starting to address that hole. And so I was working on addressing that hole throughout, you know, my years on Wall Street. And it was true, back to your question, that, you know, money became an addiction just like anything else, because mm-hmm. an addiction is effectively just, you know, seeking an external substance or thing that will make you, for a brief period, feel powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's what money did.
Right.
You know?
Well, and you talk about the being able to call any restaurant in New York City and have a broker get a great table for you, and getting a young blonde girlfriend, and
yeah,
so everybody
gets the same as, like, you know, a lot of people that are drinkers talk about how they were sort of scared, insecure, sort of teenagers, and then they had their first drink, and then all of a sudden they felt confident and they could go talk to any girl in the bar, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes they might actually even get her number. And that's sort of what money was like, honestly. It was like this artificial boost that made me feel like I was powerful. But the thing about it is, and this is the problem with all addictions, is that they end up not working,
mm-hmm.
right? Alcohol only makes you feel good for a while, and then The next morning you feel terrible. Oh, and then, by the way, the next time you want to get drunk again, it takes you more alcohol to get drunk. Mm. Well, money is exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. You get your bonus 1 year. You feel good for about 30 days, and then all of a sudden it's gone, and you're back to your life, and you start thinking about the next year's bonus. But the one thing you know is that the next year's bonus better be bigger, because if you got the same bonus, you know that that didn't work.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, and tell me how you responded to these people. Eventually, this is what caused you to walk away and do something, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is really worthwhile. But you were there during the time of the whole crash and were doing stuff that, you know, had to make you search your soul at times. But you were talking, you were seeing the limitations of unlimited wealth in your fellow workers talking about new hedge fund regulations, and they all thought it was a bad idea, and you making a suggestion, well, isn't it better for the system as a whole? And everybody stares at you, the traders mad at the government for limiting their bonuses after the crash. They're making millions of dollars in a bonus, yeah, for heaven's sake, despising right. anything and anyone that threatened their bonuses. Is that what happens with addiction? Were they all addicts, or was there something else? Because it plays out in making so many problems for other people in the world.
Well, I'll tell you, the best answer to that question is to talk about a group, a support group that's called Al-Anon. And that support group exists for loved ones of alcoholics. And the reason it exists is because when you're in a relationship with somebody who has an addiction, there's no way that you can be their first priority, right? Their first priority is whatever they're addicted to. And so what that ends up meaning is that that really is difficult on a relationship level. So if your husband, for example, is an alcoholic, then the marriage is going to suffer. And if your dad is an alcoholic, then your childhood is going to suffer. And that's because I believe that that's because, you know, addiction is it creates tunnel vision. So you can only see as far as your next drink or your next $1 million,
right,
or
right.
In the case of my bosses, your next $100 million.
Mm.
And so what that means is that you can't see how, when you're in the grip of an addiction, I don't believe that you can see how your actions are impacting other people. And I think that's the truth on Wall Street. Like, you know, and I do want to say this too, like, I think there's a lot of really nice people on Wall Street. Some of my closest friends are still on Wall Street. They're really nice guys. And I just want to say that that doesn't mean to me that they don't suffer from what I'm talking about. I think they do. But in the same way that it doesn't sort of do anybody any good to sort of vilify an alcoholic or to jail a heroin addict to punish him, the same thing is true for Wall Street. I mean, these people, and I'm only speaking from my own personal experience, and then what I saw, is I think that they're suffering from something. And I'm not asking for the world to be sympathetic to them, because, you know, the difference between, say, Wall Street guys who are addicted to money and a homeless alcoholic in the gutter is that those Wall Street guys have money and they have power,
right,
and with that comes responsibility. But it is true that they're suffering and that they're sick with something is what I think. And that makes it so that they can't see how their behavior impacts other people.
Well, how would your friends who are still on Wall Street, and how do you, we get these reports all the time, but this one is pretty stark. I'm sure you're aware of the Oxfam report yesterday. The richest 85 people on the globe own as much as the poorest 3.5 billion, or half the world population. They own $1.7 trillion. How do you take that in, and how would your people you used to work with on Wall Street take that in?
Well, for me, that means a great deal to me. And that was, I would call it like an awakening that I went through. And it wasn't this sort of grand spiritual awakening. It was more a just, you know, shift in perspective when I sort of, it was almost like I came up for air and I suddenly saw that we were all connected and that we were all responsible for each other, and that I had been given, you know, if you think about my life, right, I wrote in the piece that I sort of, you know, my dad lived, we'd live paycheck to paycheck sometimes and we struggled to grow up, and that is true. And at the same time, I grew up in America, which is definitely winning the lottery.
Yes.
I grew up a white male, which is winning the lottery twice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up with parents that like to read, and I grew up, you know, I happened to be a relatively smart kid, which is like I think sometimes people on Wall Street forget that even if you're smart, that's not something that you achieved. That's something that was given to you. Mm-hmm. That's a gift, you know, and with a gift comes responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So what made you walk out the door 3 years ago and do all kinds of things, speak in jails, juvenile detention centers, talking about getting sober, teaching a writing class, and then starting Grocery Ships? What was it like to walk out the door, and was there some event that made you just walk out of the door?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I'll tell you what, like, people often ask me about, did you leave for happiness? And the answer is that it's not about happiness, it's about humanity. Like, it wasn't that I was like, oh, I'm going to be so much happier away from Wall Street. That wasn't what it was about. It was more about, I would put it, you know, realizing that I had a sacred responsibility because I had been given this gift of life to do what the most that I could with that life. And that didn't, for a long time, I thought that the most I could do was use it to accumulate money. All of a sudden, I realized that that's not what life is about. Like, I have this short window, and what I want to do in that window is sort of pass along as much compassion and understanding and love and kindness as I can. And that was totally against what I was doing on Wall Street. And so I just decided, like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know that Grocery Ships was going to start. I didn't know what, you know, my next steps would be. But I knew that I wanted to stop living a life that was all about taking more and more for myself.
Mm-hmm. And you did start this wonderful nonprofit. You've done other things as well. But here you are starting a whole new path for yourself. What makes you decide that you're going to start a nonprofit to provide families with money to buy nutritious foods, poor families, enroll them in a nutrition cooking program, shopping education program? Why was that the way you went?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, and the real answer to that is who my teachers are. And, you know, sometimes I can, you know, I don't know, maybe I sound, you know, like confident or like that I know what I'm talking about. But really, the only reason that I was sort of able to get to where I am and get to a position where I was able to leave Wall Street is because I happened to be in enough pain when I was about to get sober from drugs and alcohol that I called a woman and asked for help. And that woman has been my guide.
Really?
For helping me kind of confront the stuff that was kind of at the root of my addiction.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, any credit that I have for leaving goes to her. And it also goes to a guy named Michael Meyer, who is one of my bosses on Wall Street and became a mentor to me. But I just happened to find some people that were incredibly big-hearted that gave me a sense of sort of my responsibility. And so in a more direct answer to your question, literally my counselor one day said, hey, you got to watch this documentary about hunger in America. I think that it might impact you. And I knew because she said it that it was important for me to watch it, and I did. And I saw families in South LA, so maybe 5 miles from my house, who were literally starving. But one of the things that is really sort of confusing and hard to understand, but also even more terrible, is that in America, hunger doesn't look like Ethiopia. You know what I'm saying? It's not, you know, starving people who haven't had food. It's actually quite the opposite. It's like hungry people who miss one meal one day and then have KFC at the next meal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this, you know, terrible correlation between obesity and hunger. And for me personally, that was really important because I grew up a very heavy kid.
Really?
Yeah, my last name is Polk, and I have an identical twin brother, and they used to call us the Pork Brothers.
Oh.
And I have a younger brother who actually reached 450 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And had to have stomach surgery. And both my parents have struggled with weight their whole life. So I knew what it was like to sort of grow up with obesity and, you know, first of all, get teased and bullied and criticized so much, but also to feel that sort of powerlessness to sort of get healthy. Like, I don't know if you've ever struggled with weight, but you know that feeling like when you're like, oh, I'm going to go on a diet tomorrow. I'm going to turn my life around. Well, that's a really scary feeling. At least for me, it is. And so I knew when I saw this issue of like hunger in South LA, and I knew how hard kind of dealing with obesity had been for me. And I thought, okay, well, these are people who have less resources than I do, and also the environments that they're in are structured to make it even harder for them to get healthy. There's less fresh produce.
Right.
There's more fast food,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times they don't have a car, so they have to walk to the nearest grocery store or nearest corner store to get food. And so I just said, like, hey, you know what? That's not fair. Like, I know that this stuff is hard, and I don't know if I have the answer to these people's problems. And I'll tell you what, I still don't. We are a very young organization that is just getting off the ground, and we've put a lot of work into it, but, you know, I don't know if it's going to work. But I will say that all I wanted to do was say, hey, I wanted to find a mother that was struggling with her own weight and also saw her kid, you know, you've probably talked about it on this show, but the epidemic of childhood obesity
sure.
and diabetes is epidemic is actually
mm-hmm.
the right word. And so, you know, these and the parents of those kids are hurting, right? Every mother wants her kid to be healthy and happy and live a long time. And so I wanted to go to that mom and say, hey, look, I don't know if I can help you, but I'm going to try. I'm going to take everything at my disposal and help you. And just from that basic idea, you know, suddenly sprung this program that we've had so much help in creating and such a good team together that has kind of worked diligently to create. And now we have, you know, what is effectively a six-month program during which, first of all, families receive financial help, and that financial help can only be spent on the healthiest food possible. So they can spend, you know, most families get about $100 a week, and they can spend that on fruit, vegetables, grains, and beans, and that's it. And then we spend the rest of the program teaching them, and not even teaching, they're teaching us as much as we're teaching them. So learning with them ways that we can all figure out to provide healthy food to our families.
Yeah, great. Let's welcome phone calls for you, Sam. Sam Polk is our guest. His story, if you didn't see the article in the Times, it's worth reading. It's on the front page of that Week in Review section, and we'll post it on our Facebook page in case you don't have access to the Times. So you can read it. It's a remarkable story. Sam's had a full life, a life not without its share of difficulties. I didn't realize he struggled with being very overweight as a child as well. A lot of addiction problems, graduated from Columbia, went to work on Wall Street, made a ton of money. His last bonus was $3.6 million. He was a bond and derivative trader for Bank of America and King Street Capital Management. Came to believe of himself that what he was doing was just to make money because it was addictive to make so much money. So he left about 3 years ago and has done a variety of good works since then, including starting Grocery Ships, which he has just told you about. He also had an idea at the end of this piece suggesting that those who are making a whole lot of money create a fund where everybody agrees to put perhaps 25% of their annual bonuses into it. And I think it's fascinating to think about where that money could go and if anybody has taken him up on that idea. So here's our phone number again, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. You can leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, during our 1 o'clock hour, last week a decision was handed down regarding net neutrality, and we'll be talking about the decision with a leading telecommunications policy expert and former presidential advisor on technology. We welcome phone calls for our guest, Sam Polk. Our number is 800-486-8655. Before we go to phone calls, because I think this is an interesting thing for all of us to think about, well, how the world would change if everybody gave 25% of their annual bonuses. When you think about that, obviously you made that call in the article for a reason, hoping that some people might think about doing that. And you must have thought, Sam, about where all of that money could go.
No, absolutely. And, You know, I'll tell you one of the reasons, or I'll tell you two of the reasons that I made that call, and they're really interesting, I think, at least. One reason is that, and this may surprise you, but there are a lot of people on Wall Street who are really unhappy. And I just know that. I know that when I left, I got phone calls from dozens of traders and salesmen saying, "Wow, you're so lucky you were able to get out."
Really?
And that must sound crazy, but I understand it because it's the same thing as being trapped in an addiction. And so I know that there's this sort of like, you know, latent humanity in Wall Street that they want to feel like they're doing something good for the world. And so I wanted to give them a concrete option if they wanted to do that. I also, to your point, saw how much good could come of it. I mean, you know, working with these folks that I talked to in South LA, you see the sort of preposterousness of, you know, getting a $2.5 million bonus and thinking that it's too low. I'm sorry, mine was $3.6 million and thinking it's too low.
Yeah.
But then you see these, you know, mothers that if somebody could give them $10,000 to make it through the next 6 months, it would change their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I wanted to kind of set up this thing. And I'll tell you what, you know, I don't know if it's going to happen, and I'll tell you why. Because for a Wall Street person to make that gesture, it would say a lot. It would say, you know, in not so many words, it would say, "I know I'm overpaid. I know I don't need all this money, and I'm willing to give it away." And, you know, Wall Street folks always tell me that they love their jobs, and I believe they do. And a lot of times they say they would do it if there was no money. And so I'm sort of saying, like, hey, here's an opportunity for you to do that if you want. And I'm not saying no money. I'm saying 75% of your, you know, multi-million dollar bonus you can keep. But wouldn't it be great to give 25% of that back? And I'll tell you the most interesting development, and I don't know whether this is going to turn into something, but just this morning I got an email from a young man who has traded bonds for big investment banks and for major hedge funds. And he reached out and he said, "Look, I will give you that 25% if you were able to pull together 12 people that also agree to do that."
That's great. Great.
So I now have one person who is willing, and I don't know if the rest will come, but I think that they might. I mean, one of the things that I sort of tell my Wall Street friends is like, look, And I, you know, this may be a little cynical of me because I'm playing not on their generosity, but on their, you know, how they appear to the world. But I'm saying, look, you know, you guys have a image problem. And
yes, they do. Right.
The world is really angry at you. And wouldn't it be great to turn that around? Wouldn't it be great for the world to be talking about all the, you know, there's Bill Gates and Warren Buffett who are getting billionaires to donate half their money. And that's, you know, the highest level, right? Billionaires. But there's a whole swath of America that, you know, maybe makes $1 million a year or has 10 million in the bank or, you know, more money than they will ever need, but are not maybe giving it away at the level that they might choose to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to say, look, maybe we can start a movement here. Maybe we can say, hey, look, this inequality has gone too far. And there's a lot of people at the lower end. And by the way, they're not struggling because they're lazy or, you know, hard workers. They're struggling because the structural unemployment in this country is staggering. And there are no jobs out there. So maybe we can use all the money that we're making at the top and help some of those folks at the bottom.
Hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Dennis in Janesville. Hi. Dennis, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead, please.
Sam.
Hi, Dennis.
For a long time, I've held that financial icons in our culture are really pushed not so much by greed, but more by power. And that this power struggle that they continually find as a monkey on their back is really more about personal insecurities, fears, and things like paranoia. I'd like to have your thoughts on that, please.
Honestly, I just completely agree with you. I think it's what you're saying is a really insightful and an important suggestion, because it means, you know, in our society, we look at these billionaires and these celebrities and we think, oh gosh, they must be so powerful. They must feel so powerful. But what if you're onto something, and I know that I experienced it myself, what if they actually feel powerless? And they feel like totally insecure, and that's what's driving them. Well, A, that means that maybe we need to stop thinking about them as our heroes. But B, it means something even bigger than that, which is that if they have $1 billion or they have $100 million and they still don't feel powerful and they still don't feel like they have enough, then they're never going to stop. And so we can, you know, sit on the sidelines saying, hey, you know, this inequality is out of control and, you know, this needs to change, but they're not going to listen to us because they're, you know, I believe they're sort of addicts in the midst of their addiction. And if that's the case, then we've got to figure out some other way to stop it.
Thanks for the call. Joel in Reesville. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would like the guest to speak toward people who are receiving assistance, who are like scamming the system.
Yeah.
And where does fear relate to this, and how do you give someone power in a constructive way?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, personally, I just think that's a great question, and the short answer is I don't know, and it's an important issue, meaning that, you know, what I hear you asking is like, you know, there is this feeling sometimes where you're giving folks stuff and it's not helping anything. You know, you're just, they're remaining dependent and they're not doing anything. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that and I could talk to you about it. But in the end, I do know that it feels not so good to help folks that it feels like are taking advantage of the system, right? One thing I'll tell you about grocery ships is that the way that we've dealt with this issue is that we insist families apply. So we're not trying to give groceries to everybody. We're saying, hey, look, this is a really difficult problem. If you are willing to put in the work and you want to do this, then we've got your back. But you have to come to us and you have to apply. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever struggled with food on your end, but it's really tough. And really changing your food and your eating habits for 6 months is really difficult. And so we want to support that.
Thanks, Joel, very much for your call. Sarah in Zion. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. You know, I'm so interested in what you're saying, Sam, and it reminded me of a book that I found in the public library that's called When Society Becomes an Addict, and her whole theory is that our society and Western societies function as a whole with the same mindset as an addict, that our goals, our values are addictive. And she has, because at some point in our history as humans, we switched from finding our purpose in life from social cooperation with other people and with the natural world, and we replaced it with dominating other people and the world and having power over them.
Yeah.
And that's what puts fundamentally a hole in our society and in the people in our society, because we're trying to find this satisfaction and connection, and we can't find it in our society because
yeah.
The values that predominate are anti that connection.
And Sam.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I completely agree with you, and it really makes me think about Dr. Martin Luther King and how he saw, you know, the most egregious bigotry, but he didn't see it as a crime to be punished. He saw it as an illness to be healed. And I think that is the sort of consequence of, I think that's the right and really graceful way to look at this situation, which if what you're saying is true, that the society is, in effect, one great big addict that is struggling with one great big addiction, well, then that society needs to be healed. And by the way, I'm not saying that I have the answer for how to heal it, but I will tell you my own personal experience, because I have been on both sides of that. I have been an addict that is actively pursuing both money and or drugs and alcohol, but also an addict pursuing money. And I've found my way to the other side. And by the way, that doesn't mean that I'm totally cured. It just means that I've sort of regained some of my humanity and gotten control over my addictions. But the point I'm trying to get to is that the process of healing for me was really hard and really long and really like focused on, you know, kind of, you know, I counseling, for lack of a better word, like talking about, you know, my old pain and really processing some old feelings and re-educating my belief systems about my own value and about my own place in the world. And so that's a long way of saying, like, I think that our whole world has a little bit of that to do. I think Dr. Martin Luther King obviously was tremendous in sort of producing healing on a national level. And I think, you know, one of the things for me is I'm starting to think that inequality is, and I don't at all want to be heard as saying that it's inequality is somehow bigger than bigotry, because I don't believe it is, but I think it's another big thing that we might need some national healing on a national level.
Yeah, well, and some answers, because there's obviously, that's such a dramatic statistic that I've said a couple times, 85 people owning as much as 3.5 billion people, or half the world. There's something that stops you in your tracks about that. It's interesting you mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King yesterday, of course, his birthday celebration nationally. But you also mentioned him in your article, that you had read Taylor Branch's 3-volume book set on Dr. Martin Luther King. And obviously, he entered your soul.
I mean, he absolutely did, because more than anything, he was like a call to action. I don't know if anybody who's listening has ever said the same thing that I did, but what I said to myself, what I'd said to myself for years is, oh, well, they've fixed sort of all the big problems. They've fixed, you know, a misogyny towards women, and they've fixed, you know, racism in America. But then, you know, as I continued to grow older, I realized that, A, not only had they not fixed either of those two things, but there was also other huge issues out there. Our swelling prison populations, an obesity epidemic, a sexual assault epidemic. And what I mean by that is, like, the sheer number of women that are abused as children and as young women in this world is, to me, staggering. And the fact that we are not talking about it more and more is one of the great problems I personally see. And so it was really like coming to understand that, you know, by saying that there was no other problems, I was really hiding from what I believe to be my true responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, like, can you imagine these young men and women volunteers who were freedom riders, who went onto the buses and drove into the most bigoted, racist areas in the nation, and where they were met by lynch mobs, and they walked out of the bus to take the beating? I mean, those were people, those were heroes that understood the responsibility that they had to heal the rest of the world. And I'm not at all putting myself into that category, because, you know what, no matter what I do in my life, I will never get close to what those people did. But it is a call to action to say, hey, you know, those people did that, so there must be something that I can do. And maybe it's small. Maybe it's starting a startup nonprofit with big dreams. Maybe it's volunteering at my local store. Maybe it's giving away 25% of my money. But there's definitely more to be done than we're doing, or than I was doing, for sure. And I have Dr. Martin Luther King to thank for that.
So what would happen if you said tomorrow you were going to call some of your buddies you used to work with on Wall Street and say, listen, I want to take you to lunch, and you got them the finest table, of course, in the New York restaurant or wherever. I'll fly you out to wherever you're living now, Los Angeles, and take you to a great place to eat. And then the lunch conversation was what you were just talking about. Would everybody say, Sam, you've gone off your rocker?
Absolutely.
Or they would.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, when if you believe this paradigm of addiction that I'm talking about, when you're in the midst of that, your perspective is very limited. I'm holding my sort of hands up around my face just to show, like, sort of tunnel vision. And that's what it's sort of like. And so that's actually one of the scary things in my mind, which is, you know, when we saw that Occupy Wall Street movement sweep not only America but the nation, it seemed to me such a clear sort of cry that something was going on in America, something was wrong. And Wall Street, I mean, I cannot tell you how little they talked about it,
really,
or paid attention to it,
huh,
or thought about it. It doesn't even factor into their consciousness. And you know, and also, you know, another thing that I want to say is, like, you know, my Wall Street friends there's a lot of them that are sort of supporting me and standing up for me, but they're also really pushing me to say, hey, there are really good people on Wall Street.
Sure.
And I really do want to make that point. Like, there are some nice, kind people on Wall Street, much in the same way that there were some nice, kind bigots in Alabama. And they deserve to be treated as full human beings just as much as anybody who's not on Wall Street, is what I believe. And my belief is that they're a little bit sick, and they have some belief systems that need to be reeducated and probably some wounds that need to be healed. But at the same time, there's a lot of love that they need to get and a lot of support, I think. And I know that sounds amorphous, and I can almost hear people on the other end of the line bridling. But I do think that that's an important thing. Like, you know, The Wolf of Wall Street obviously came out, and one of the things that I think that movie did is it gave people an easy way to judge Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the reasons that my article, which is, you know, still the number one most tweeted article on the New York Times.
Is it?
Wow. And it's still number two most emailed.
Uh-huh.
And I think that, I don't think that's because of my skill as a writer. I think that it's because I hit on this national nerve, because I showed a Wall Street guy in a really human way that people saw as a full person. And that then changes the conversation, because it's not about sort of evil bad guys. It's about people that are sick that need to be healed.
Right. More phone calls for Sam in a moment. Sam Polk is our guest. He is now founder and executive director of Grocery Ships, and calls himself a recovering pancake addict. He is the author of a piece which appears, we'll put it on our Facebook page in the New York Times on Sunday, about his years on Wall Street as a derivative trader for Bank of America and King Street Capital Management. He was making a ton of money, but it was never enough money. He left about 3 years ago, compares what was going on with him on Wall Street to earlier addictive behavior, and that there are money addicts, and a lot of people on Wall Street may fit that definition. He stopped 3 years ago. He's married. He's spoken in jails, juvenile detention centers about getting sober. He's taught a writing class to girls in the foster system and started this nonprofit we've been talking about. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Sam, and let's go to Jake in Milwaukee. Hello.
Yeah, I personally, since the recession, abhor Wall Street, the stockbrokers, derivative traders, because they've ruined and hurt millions upon millions of people's lives all over this country. And none of them, basically none of them, have been frog-marked to not jail, but at least to a trial to see what they did. And I personally, I hope your thing can work, but I can understand what the Bolsheviks felt like and what other people felt like in revolutions based on income inequality, because, to be honest, I think people in Wall Street itself is a useless entity that sucks money and people's hard work up to a small amount of people and screws everyone else over.
Thanks, Jake, for the call. Sam.
Jake, you know, let me tell you that I agree with you. And when I say that Wall Street folks are sick, I don't mean that they don't owe the world an apology. I think they do. And let me go one better, I hope, which is that, you know, I was part of that system for 8 years. And I was personally a part of that system. I didn't do anything illegal or anything like that, but I was part of that functioning system. And I'm sorry. I didn't see at the time that the actions I was taking to make myself rich were, just by their very nature, you know, crushing people at the bottom of the system. I didn't see that. I do now, and the only what I can offer you now is an apology, and I'm really sorry.
And what about the behavior of other people who ran some of those banks? Is there a case to be made for prosecution of some people who have not been prosecuted?
Look, I just think that that's... How to answer this? Like, I think there probably is, yes. And I think that we exist in a world that tells us that if we punish a few people, things will change. But my guess is that if you sent, you know, the former CEO of Lehman Brothers and the former CEO of Citibank to jail or anything like that, or any of the other people that people call for, you know, jail terms, I don't think that anything would change. I think things have to change on a much more systemic level.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Roxanne in the Upper Peninsula. Hi.
Hi. Say, I appreciate what you're doing in the nutrition area with the grocery ships. I recently drove from Upper Peninsula, Michigan to San Bernardino to visit my mother, who's in a senior citizen high-rise, and was shocked at, and I have lived in Minneapolis for 25 years, but I was shocked at the number of homeless people in San Bernardino. Yeah. And talking to the folks, I stayed there for over a week in the senior citizen building, and the lack of nutrition and funds for those seniors to buy fresh fruits and vegetables and just the healthy foods that any person has to have good nourishment, energy, healing their bodies, and maintaining a brain function.
Totally.
So I'm trying to write some articles. I'm trying to find some little newspapers or some sort of periodicals that will accept my nutrition articles. I have some training in that as a nutrition coach, but I just wanted to thank you so much for at least trying to help with this food problem we have.
Thanks, Roxanne, for the call.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I have two things to say about that. One, a few people, this sounds like, have gotten tripped up on the name grocery ships, so let me explain it. It's like scholarships for groceries. So grocery ships, and you can read our website at groceryships.com. And what our caller was just saying about especially healthy food for seniors, I just want to give a shout-out to a gentleman that I know in L.A. named Robert Eggers, who is running an incredible organization called L.A.'s Kitchen, which takes all the food, all the produce that is thrown away from the Central Valley farms and ships them to Los Angeles, and has a team of food preparers that he hires from jails, so ex-cons, to prepare food to then give to seniors. And it is an incredible organization. And if you haven't checked out L.A. Kitchen, I would really urge you to. And Robert Eggers is a visionary guy who's trying to feed the swelling baby boomer population.
Mm. How did you get your article published in the New York Times? Did they just take it right away?
You won't even believe it. I literally sent it to Op-Ed at New York Times.
Wow.
I didn't know a person at the New York Times.
No.
Nothing. And then we've been, you know, the New York Times is the New York Times, so we like... You know, it took them a couple months to get back to me. Then they did, and they asked me to rewrite it, so I did. Then I waited another couple months. I didn't even follow up just because it's the New York Times. You know, how could you imagine
right.
that they would publish anything that I'd ever written?
Right.
And then I sent this my wonderful editor, who I will forever be thankful for, not honestly for me, but for the grocery ships families that this has helped so much. And she, I sent her a note on January 1st, and she said, "Hey, you know what? It's bonus time. It might be a good time for this." And then she read it, and she said, "Wow, this is fantastic." She read my revised edition and said, "This is fantastic," and started talking to me about printing it. But then I didn't even know until Wednesday of last week that they were even going to print it. And then I didn't even know by Friday. I don't know if you saw it on the physical paper.
Yeah, I get the paper.
But it was the biggest placement. I mean,
I know it's on the front page.
You know, I had Thomas Friedman was below me, and I have read Thomas Friedman my whole life, and he is a hero of mine. And all of a sudden, my article was bigger than him. And you know what? I really say this with all honesty. Like, okay, you know, the world is telling me that I'm sort of special right now, but I'm not thankful for that reason. Like, something happened, and I think that I'm sort of a little vessel in a much bigger thing that's happening, and it has to do with the universe, and it has to do with change that needs to happen, because the idea that I could write, you know, from my little computer in Los Angeles, write a little bit about my story and then all of a sudden the New York Times comes out and plucks it out of obscurity and gives it the greatest placement you could ever imagine. And then that story goes absolutely viral bananas online. Speaks to, for me, it speaks to a higher power and a bigger thing at work.
Yeah. Oh, what a story, Sam. Well, I'm so glad that you were with us today. I just thought it was a remarkable story, and thank you for taking the time. And all the best
thank
to you.
You.
It'll be interesting.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, to you as well. Sam Polk. The article will be on our Facebook page. Isn't that a story? It's just how he just wrote it, and they published it. And again, it's groceryships.com if you'd like more information about his nonprofit. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.